Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Inside. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. CAL FIRE Chief Tom Porter is retiring after more than 20 years of service with the department, the last three in the top position. Appointed by Governor Newsom back in January of 2019, Porter succeeded Ken Pimlott, who was chief from 2010 to 2018. In a statement sent just about 24 hours ago, Chief Porter explained that he'll retire effective December 10th so that he could focus on himself, his family, and aging parents. Porter took over just a few months after the CAMP FIRE tore through the towns of Paradise, Magalia, Polga, and Concow, killing 85 people in its immediate aftermath. He was actually a guest with Beth Rujak on Insight in May of 2019, where they talked about the lessons learned.
What we have learned from Paradise is that even a community that did, by all accounts, everything right in preparation for this kind of a fire, the fire outstripped what the expectation was of the worst case scenario. That is the climate change effect. And so we're seeing things happening that are outside of even our worst case scenario planning. And so now we're going back and reviewing plans. We're going back and identifying where the most vulnerable elements of a community are.
Again, that interview was in May of 2019. In the year and a half since, Chief Porter led the state through record-setting wildfire seasons, with the search now on for his replacement. We reached out to Chief Porter to join us and are waiting to hear back. In the meantime, CAP Radio's state government reporter Scott Rodd is here now to put Tom Porter's time as CAL FIRE chief into context and perspective. Welcome, Scott.
Thanks, Vicky, for having me on.
Well, Scott, yesterday when you broke the news of Porter's retirement on Twitter, you were actually in an editorial meeting doing your job. Was this something you heard rumblings about, or did it come as a surprise?
You know, I had heard some kind of vague rumblings a little earlier in the wildfire seasons, but that died down. And then it wasn't until late last week that I was hearing more concrete rumors sort of circulating about internal announcements, and started poking around on it, started asking some folks, and it wasn't until yesterday morning that I was able to confirm for sure that Porter had announced that he plans to retire on December 10th. He made a morning announcement yesterday to the staff at CAL FIRE. And so it was a little surprising, just in terms of considering we're in a moment right now where CAL FIRE really is one of the most prominent departments in the Newsom administration when it comes to top priorities. You know, the wildfire crisis in California is just such a pressing issue, from the Oregon border down to the southern border. So it was a bit of a surprise.
What stands out to you about the timeliness of this departure?
Well, certainly it makes sense in terms of we're sort of coming to the end of this year's wildfire season. It by no means is completely the end. There are still areas of the state that are parched, that are still, that could still burn, certainly. But we're sort of coming to closer to the close of it. And so that does make sense. But certainly the timeliness in terms of, the duration of his tenure, I think, is interesting. He was in the role for about 3 years. That was shorter than some of his predecessors. So I think that is notable. I've talked to some folks who said that they felt that they were a bit surprised by that. And some other folks within CAL FIRE were also surprised by the duration of his time in the role.
Right. I mean, it amounts to nearly 3 years, which is relatively short, as you mentioned. Time is only one factor, though, taking over during historic and at times record-setting wildfire seasons that even seasoned firefighters never experienced in their decades-long career. What role do you think that played in this decision?
This is a little bit of speculation, but I can't just say that these wildfire seasons for, as you said, seasoned firefighters, so folks from on the front lines to the folks who are, kind of strategizing from Sacramento, it's been extremely taxing. These are wildfire seasons, these last two, that, folks couldn't even conceive of, 5-10 years ago. We were at a point in 2017 and 18 where we thought we had reached kind of the crisis level, sort of the maximum crisis of what wildfires could produce in California. And we've seen wildfire seasons that have exceeded that, in some cases far exceeded that, in terms of not only the number of acres burned, which is kind of a crude metric, but the intensity of these fires, the destruction that they've caused. And so I would speculate that that probably did play a role. I mean, it's been extremely taxing for folks to in Cal Fire to respond to these fires, to basically make the most of fairly limited resources to try to, you know, wrap their arms around this crisis.
Yeah, and given these wildfires have just been relentless over the last several years, you know, it kind of, I went back during his tenure to actually look at the wildfire incidents back in 2019, 2020, 2021, many of which I covered, you covered a lot of them as well. And I was just struck by the dramatic increase in acres that were burned during this very short time period. I mean, it was like 250,000 acres statewide in 2019, that jumped up to 4.2 million in 2020. We're over 3 million acres this year. And given that we've been there firsthand, we understand that just one wildfire is devastating and life-changing for individuals and communities. But from a statewide fire chief perspective, responding to a more than tenfold increase seamlessly from one year to the next, not to mention a pandemic, what stands out about his leadership?
I think you're absolutely right that over the course of, you know, just the 3 years that he was in office, it was a tremendous whiplash. You know, again, we came off of 2017, 2018, where there were, you know, seriously destructive wildfires in across the state. And as you mentioned, in 2019, the total acres burned across the state was about 250,000. And there were still tragic fires. You know, the Kincade fire was devastating. But just in terms of the scope, it was significantly less. And so, you know, again, what seemed like perhaps the maximum sort of crisis level of wildfires in 2017 and 18 turned out to be kind of a dress rehearsal with a sort of lull in between. And then we had 2020. Over 4 million acres, 2021, they're still tabulating, but we've crossed 3 million acres. And so that kind of whiplash, I do think, has defined Porter's leadership and his response. You know, he had to go from a year that looked relatively mild, where in years where a quarter million acres burned, you know, you have an opportunity to do more fire prevention work, potentially. You have more opportunities to work with communities on defensible space and home hardening. So instead of running around and trying to put out fires across the state, you can do a bit more preparation work. And that opportunity really diminished in 2020 and 2021. And on top of that, you also have the pandemic. And so, you know, you have a situation where, you know, going from, again, a relatively mild year to 2 years in a row that were just breakneck in terms of trying to respond to these fires, and, you know, having a pandemic that clogged logistics, that created even greater stress on the system, it really was a whiplash.
Right. I want to go back to just this recently, this past August, during daily press briefings at the time of the Caldor fire. Chief Porter showcased really his ability to be blunt when discussing the gravity of wildfires across the state. So let's just take a brief listen to a comment he made about the future of wildfires in our state.
You've heard me say this before. Every acre can and will burn someday in this state. Be ready now.
All right, so hanging on that last statement, be ready now. I mean, obviously, there's an individual component to this in terms of preparedness, defensible space, home hardening, as you were talking about. But let's focus on the state firefighting agency role he's tasked with leading. I mean, your reporting found discrepancies, major ones at that, between what the governor and Cal Fire were telling the public and what was actually being done in terms of wildfire management. So if you can just walk us through what was actually accomplished and what were the missteps.
Sure. So when Newsom entered office, he made wildfire response and especially prevention a big part of his platform. He actually, I believe it was his first press conference that he held, it was up in Colfax, and he, you know, talked all about emergency response and wildfires. And he said, basically, this situation has to change. And he tasked Cal Fire with finding, you know, basically priorities to ensure that the state was ready for wildfires and steps it could take to prevent or mitigate them from the jump. One of the things that they identified, Cal Fire identified, were these 35 projects across the state that would protect some of the most vulnerable communities from wildfires. the total acreage of those projects that were identified was 90,000 acres through fuel breaks, commercial thinning, prescribed burning. Over the next year, Cal Fire worked on those projects. And in early 2020, Newsom essentially said, mission accomplished. We've completed these projects. They've collectively treated 90,000 acres. And he continued to talk about these projects. And you know, a year and a half later, I and my editor said, well, why does he keep talking about these projects? Let's dig into them. Let's see what actually happened. And it turned out that the numbers had been skewed a bit. And we found that the state had actually only treated, again, that means forest thinning, prescribed burn, 12,000 acres, actually less than 12,000 acres. So significantly less than what they had previously claimed. And this created a bit of an uproar. Folks wanted to understand, you know, why were these numbers skewed? What actually was done? Were these communities protected? And a couple things to note, 90,000 acres of forest treatment and forest management is not really, it's a drop in the bucket of what overall needs to happen. But this was a key platform and a key policy for Governor Newsom. But another thing, you know, the state said that the work that was done did protect communities. They also said that the overall sort of 90,000 acres that were identified, that was land that was protected by the work that was done. So that's what they had to say. But it did cause, you know, as I said before, a lot of scrutiny for Cal Fire. It did cause lawmakers to say, we need to understand what's happening here and understand more broadly what's happening with wildfire prevention in the state and making sure that this work is actually getting done.
When talking about a discrepancy of 12,000 compared to 90,000, I mean, that's, you know, what, 15% or something. I'm just doing rough math in my head. What did Chief Porter tell you when you addressed this major discrepancy and what was actually accomplished?
You know, one of the things he said that stood out to me was, you know, he took some responsibility in terms of, you know, feeling the need to, he said Cal Fire basically needed to do a better job of educating the governor's office and the public about what wildfire prevention means and what this work looks like, the impact that it'll have. And so, you know, Porter did come out and say, look, some of this is on us. We need to do a better job of communicating and making clear the work that we did and the impact that it would have. And a lot of the stuff is nuanced. You know, 1 acre treated can have a big impact. But at the same time, you know, again, as you said, when the governor comes out and claims that a certain number of acres, 90,000, were treated, that means one thing. And when that amount hasn't been done, when it's significantly less, it's important for the public to know that.
Chief Porter also regularly talked about the role of climate change and forest management shortfalls. We listened to it back in May of 2019 when he had just was months into taking over as Cal Fire chief. And these shortfalls arguably do predate his leadership. But this conversation, was this a departure from past chiefs or did he actually elevate the conversations when it comes to surrounding these interconnected issues of wildfires?
You know, it's been known for a while that fire prevention is something that needs to be prioritized as much, if not perhaps even more, than fire suppression. You know, so that basically means doing the forest management work to ensure that these fires don't explode, as opposed to waiting for them to start and going in and trying to attack them. That's been known and acknowledged for a while, but Porter really did elevate this. You know, he talked about it more. He talked about being more aggressive about it. He talked about basically, you know, you can't firefight your way out of the situation we're in right now in California. It has to be more nuanced. It has to be more methodical in terms of going in and doing the work when the fires aren't burning. That's probably your best shot of mitigating the spread of fires to begin with. So he really did elevate these conversations, and he made it something that, you know, was discussed regularly in addition to climate change, you know, and these two things go hand in hand. But those were two big talking points that Porter often addressed when he was talking about the sheer size and scope and threat of wildfires in California.
Well, then looking ahead, I mean, any thoughts on what Governor Newsom will be looking for in a replacement? And not to mention, he also tweeted, and we also are learning that the second in command is stepping down as well, retiring as well. Those are two big openings when it comes to wildfire response and mitigation.
Absolutely. You know, the top two leaders in a department as important as Cal Fire vacating their roles in close succession, you know, that leaves essentially an opening for, you know, new leaders to step in, obviously, but for a new, for different, for a new perspective, a different perspective, a new culture from the top down sort of to be established. So I am very curious to see who is going to step into that role. What experience have they had? It's tough to say. It's a little bit of a parlor game to say, you know, who will Newsom, you know, choose as a successor. My understanding is previous chiefs often offer recommendations for who may succeed them. So, you know, I'm going to be poking around to see if there have been any sort of recommendations offered from Porter. But this is a big moment, a seriously significant moment. I don't want to understate it at all. You know, having these top two positions open and who Newsom chooses is really going to dictate California's approach to fire response in the coming years. And again, we are at a crisis level right now with wildfires, and what we choose to do from here will have ripple effects and ramifications for years to come.
Then let's end with funding. I mean, there is a sizable amount of money. It has evolved over this year when looking at the state budget. But whoever is going to take Chief Porter's place will be charged with spending and investing a good amount of this funding for wildfire prevention and mitigation. So what will you be focusing on in the months ahead?
You know, I ended the story that I wrote yesterday on Chief Porter's retirement with, you know, the successor will be entering into a role with continuing peril. You know, this wildfire crisis is not going anywhere, but a glimmer of promise, because the legislature and the governor did allocate just in the last year over $1 billion for fire prevention work, fire mitigation work, forest health and forest management. And that's significantly more than what's been allocated in the past. And so I think that is really important. I've said this a number of times before. Allocating money is not a success in terms of stopping wildfires. You know, in order to prevent these fires from happening, you have to get the work done. So you may have a big pot of money, but how it's spent, whether it's spent, that's what's really going to matter. So I'll be very curious to see, you know, how Porter's successor takes this opportunity where there's a lot of money to spend on fire prevention and community protection, see how they spend it and see what kind of impact it has.
Thanks, Scott.
Thank you.
And that is Cap Radio state government reporter Scott Rodd. And again, our invitation to Chief Tom Porter remains open. Also, we've posted the 2019 interview with Beth Rujak on Insight. You can just head over to capradio.org/insight. Up next, from across the state line through the Capitol and the Central Valley, food banks join us to discuss their needs this holiday season. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Well, as we head into the holiday season, seasonal cravings start popping up. For me, it's pumpkin pie. And we start thinking about the food we're going to serve or just, you know, simply eat and enjoy and be grateful for those who are cooking it up for us. While there's a need all year long, a lot of us also focus on giving to others in need. The USDA estimates that 13.8 million households experience food insecurity throughout the country. And here in California, it's about 8 million people, or 20% of residents. That's one in five. So to better understand the need in our area, joining us are Nicole Lamboli with the Food Bank of Northern Nevada, Dr. Leonard Hansen with the Emergency Food Bank in Stockton, and Blake Young with the Sacramento Food Bank. Collectively, they serve nearly 500,000 people with food insecurity. Welcome all to Insight.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning. Each food bank serves such a unique community. So let's just start off by sharing the needs that you individually face. Nicole, let's start with you in Northern Nevada.
Great. Well, thank you for having me. And yes, our Northern Nevada territory encompasses both urban and very rural, and in some cases, frontier communities where there is very limited access. But then we also have the service area that includes part of the eastern slope of the Sierras in California, with which we partner with so many of our food bank partners in California to meet the needs. So geography really does impact many of the communities that we serve. We cover a 90,000 square mile service area, and food insecurity among people is very different. Sometimes they need assistance to help meet their monthly household food budget. In other cases, they lack access to grocery stores. They literally live hundreds of miles away from the nearest grocery store or community market, which sometimes, particularly during the pandemic, has struggled to keep its shelves stocked with food.
You know, when looking at such a large area, that 90,000 square miles is, I believe, is what you said, and it, which also includes the eastern slope of the Sierra, not to mention wildfire season. I mean, a lot of these evacuees actually went into your area. How did that further compound and the challenges and the need that you were seeing in northern Nevada?
You know, the Feeding America Network and food banks all across our region work collectively and collaboratively to make sure that no one goes hungry. So we coordinate just as we would in a daily basis on emergency response, and we provide support and resources. So no matter where those individuals go, we can provide them. We basically don't operate during an emergency with boundaries. It did impact us a little bit. Particularly up in the Susanville area, where they struggled not only with losing pantries, but also losing power that resulted in the loss of perishable items. But together, we were able to figure out how to get food resources to those individuals, whether they were temporarily displaced or, in some cases, they are finding themselves permanently displaced and need emergency food assistance.
Let's head to San Joaquin County. Leonard, you serve the Stockton area. Tell us about the needs and who you're actually serving in Stockton.
The Emergency Food Bank serves all of Stockton and all of San Joaquin County. So there is a demand all the way through. We have a varied response in order to make sure that we get food to people. For example, we do a whole series of pantries. We actually do one here at the food bank from 9 to 12, Monday through Friday. We serve 19% more people this year than we served during the pandemic. And the pandemic was 43% more than we served the year before. We've already served more people this year than we served last year at this one. Then we also have 62 mobile farmer market sites. We have 23 partner pantries. We reached out in July of last year and joined with 211 in Stockton, which is a family resource call-in. And we are now serving 500 DoorDash customers, where the food is picked up by DoorDash people and brought out every Tuesday. So there's multiple ways to address the food insecurity. It doesn't mean that we've cured it in any way. It's just we've got a result that we have patched it. And we have much to do from there.
Yeah, certainly. When you're talking about a 19% increase over a 43% increase that was last year, what are you hearing from people that live that are using your services that are suffering from food insecurity? What stories are missing in this larger conversation?
They are unsure, just like many of us. They don't know where things are. And the COVID confuses them. The changes, the Delta variant, all of the things that have happened to us. There is an enormous amount of unemployment for whatever reason in the lines at the pantries. And you can talk to them about that. And that, of course, mixes up their entire life.
You know, Blake, Sacramento County also is incredibly diverse and large. What are the needs in your community?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, Sacramento is higher than the state and national average in hunger statistics. So, you know, we have a huge job, as these two have articulated as well. We serve both urban, suburban, and a rural population down in the Galt and the Delta area. During COVID, we experienced 100% increase, and now we're serving 100,000 more people than we did prior to the pandemic. So, we like the others, we have over 150 partner agencies. They're community-based organizations, they're food pantries, they're health clinics, et cetera, that partner with us to get food. to folks. And, you know, our focus is, you know, families, individuals, but we have a robust senior program where we're delivering food to homebound seniors. We work with our school districts to try to get food to schools, et cetera, so, and kids. So no different than these guys. I mean, we you know, unfortunately, the food banks are becoming the staple for a lot of people, and much, much different than it was 20 years ago. And we do not see that slowing down, not just the pandemic, but all of us experience high cost of living in California. And the marginal employment just exacerbates the situation. So, you know, we're really trying to strategically plan for the next 5 to 7 years to be in this situation. And we just got to be mindful of our resources.
Well, given that perspective of 20 years and all, obviously reducing hunger is paramount in all of your passion, what is missing? What do we need to know about this conversation about an increasing need for food?
Well, I think there's a misconception. I'm probably the number one question I ask is, who are people that are hungry? What do they look like? And they look like us. I mean, honestly, I mean, there are, the pandemic highlighted it, but I mean, there are beautiful moms and dads that are raising their children that just simply can't afford the cost of living. You have seniors making decisions about buying medication versus buying food. What I think, you know, the community needs to know is, I mean, a better nourished community is a more productive and happy community. And, you know, food banks play an important role in this. Our partners play an important role in this. But a well-fed community, it has less crime. It's more productive. And so, you know, we play a very, very integral part of making sure our community is well.
I'm curious, we've been covering supply chain issues that are just far-reaching. Has that actually impacted the amount of food coming into your food banks? Has there been an impact?
We have seen that, especially in the last 4 months, where things like mac and cheese all of a sudden dried up, where we couldn't find canned corn. And I'm sure everyone's aware that it's very difficult to find turkeys. We're doing a holiday meal giveaway next Tuesday, and we need a lot of turkeys. So it's been difficult to find those.
Nicole, given that you're in Northern Nevada, I think of I-80, which is a main thoroughfare for truck drivers, and that's been impacted as well. How has the supply chain issue impacted your food bank?
Yes, I think we all recognize that there are challenges in getting certain types of food, but sometimes it's also a timing issue of when you can get that food, when it does become available. And I think, like Leonard has said, there's a shortage of turkeys. There's also a shortage of chickens. We do a chicken distribution, a whole chicken distribution as part of our holiday meal. We place that order back in the summer. And these are purchased items. These are not donated items. And 2 weeks ago, we received a call that they can't fulfill the whole order. Part of it is a shortage supply. The other is the delivery time. They can't meet the delivery dates that were agreed upon. And we've seen that from food, from just even paper supplies that are necessary to move the food in the manner in which we do. So there's a lot of struggles. The other day, there was just an article written that there's a shortage of 80,000 drivers. Earlier in the summer, we heard there was a shortage of 50,000 drivers. So that really does impact us in our daily work, but also in the ability to get food that we source either from, you know, the producers or the donors to those of us here in our communities. So we're all struggling with transportation issues as well as supply issues.
Blake, I see you nodding along. I imagine it's a similar story in Sacramento County.
It, very, very similar. Yeah. I mean, from order to dock time has taken longer. We have definitely some producers and manufacturers that can't fulfill full orders. You know, but I really, you know, my attention really is on the client and the people receiving our services. I mean, with inflation, the cost of food, you know, we, you know, if you do an analysis, a Thanksgiving meal is going to cost about 70% more than it did in 2020. that's a significant increase. So, you know, thank God that we're all working hard to try to nourish our communities, but they are going to struggle significantly through these holidays, and my heart really, really pours out to them.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and if you're just joining us, we're speaking with three food banks in Northern Nevada, Stockton, and Sacramento about the needs that they have this holiday season. Well, let's head into the holiday season. You know, during this time, many schools and businesses are having canned food drives. What other items do you need? I mean, we're even hearing about perishable foods like turkeys and chickens. Leonard, let's start with you in San Joaquin County.
We use an enormous amount of peanut butter, and it's very short these days, and it's one of those nutrient dense foods that we can hand out that's easy to use for multiple. Especially, we do homeless street outreach for the homeless twice a week, take our trucks out and set up a pop-up pantry into the encampments. Well, we need lots of peanut butter for that, for example. So that one's been a surprise for us. Been difficult to get around when we can't get it. We had a terrible time coming up with stuffing again this year for the holidays. So yeah, there are multiple food drives going on, and they usually result in half a van or at least a couple of good barrels, and we're always appreciative.
And are you having an activity scheduled for Thanksgiving and the holidays?
We are indeed. We have our annual turkey meal giveaway. We moved it last year and doing it again this year at the San Joaquin Fairgrounds. So that allows us to maintain a certain amount of social distancing, to do touchless tailgate where it's going into their car, and we can wrap the cars all the way around the property of the fairgrounds. We served last year 2,231 cars in 6 hours. And we expect to do the same this year.
Or maybe even potentially more. Nicole, over in Northern Nevada, in such a wide area as well that you serve, what are some of the unique needs aside from, you know, us reflexively thinking canned goods?
Yeah, we spend a lot of time looking at how do we move fresh produce to our clients. And that can be a challenge, obviously. So we will be focusing a little bit on that. But we are also, we couple our fresh produce with obviously the shelf stable items. Through food drives, obviously, we don't collect fresh produce. That is either usually through the donated stream or the purchase stream. But we ask our supporters who are running food drives to make sure that they are giving us, you know, low sodium vegetables, fruit in juice as opposed to sugar. We try and really focus on getting that healthy, nutritious food so that people who have dietary restrictions have options. We run several healthy food pantry initiatives that offer whole grains as well as traditional type pasta. Hearty meals are other things, soups. Soups have been very difficult to get. And it's improving in the supply chain, but we encourage people to help donate those items. Canned tuna and canned chicken are always needed in the community. And this year we will be doing holiday meals. We are doing a pre-registration and we are currently full. But the question there is, if people are needing assistance with holiday meals, we know they need assistance throughout the year. And that's really what we do. So we are trying to connect those people to the programs and services that either we operate or our partners operate, so that we make sure that they have access to healthy, nutritious food all year long and not just at the holiday. Because I think sometimes we forget that a person who doesn't have a holiday meal is likely facing food insecurity on a daily basis.
Yeah. Blake, we obviously know Run to Feed the Hungry here in Sacramento, and that is coming up next week. But going back to items, I mean, we were hearing Leonard talk about peanut butter and Nicole talking about tuna and canned soups, even mac and cheese boxes. What surprised you about what's kind of dwindling in your supply that you normally didn't have to worry about?
Well, let's talk turkeys. We give chickens and turkeys, and you know, I mean everything. I can't pick out one item. I mean, you know, everyone's screaming about how we're short on turkeys. We, meaning all of us. And Leonard talked about peanut butter. It is a very, very important commodity for us. Tuna as well, chicken as well. You know, we work with our focus, not just during the holidays, but it's probably a little bit more during the holidays, is trying to get all of the food resources to our partner agencies. Because the pandemic has still impacted our community and our partner agencies, we, like Leonard had mentioned, we operate a couple what we call mega drive-through distributions, where we'll serve probably 10,000 people during the holidays in a drive-through fashion. I go back to thinking about the folks that need our services, and you know, this is going to be a difficult year for all of us. And then we head into the Christmas season, and just thinking about that. So, you know, my mind's always on, you know, our struggling folks and how they're going to get resources. But on the bright side, we have our Run to Feed the Hungry, and we're excited about that. This is an event that allows us a big platform to talk about hunger issues and get the community excited about raising funds to specifically support that need. So
I just want to thank all three of you for joining us today. We were talking with the Food Bank of Northern Nevada, the Emergency Food Bank in Stockton, which serves San Joaquin County, as well as the Sacramento Food Bank in Sacramento County. Still ahead, delayed book releases and paper shortages. We're also going to learn how the supply chain issues are affecting the publishing industry. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Well, many of us became aware of the supply chain about 20 months ago when there was a shortage of toilet paper. Now, a different kind of paper is hard to get a hold of. Books. And with the holidays coming up, we need books. I sat down with CAP Radio Morning Edition host Donna Appadoni about how the supply chain issues are affecting the publishing industry. Donna, we are learning about the far-reaching effects of the supply chain issues globally and across the country. I wouldn't have even thought about the publishing industry. What sparked all of this for you?
I didn't think about it either, Vicki. I was talking with John Lesqua. A lot of people know him. He's been at CAP Radio a lot. He writes best-selling legal thrillers. He was going to do an interview with me and for a book that was coming out the middle of November. And he contacted me and said, I have to push it back. My publisher said the book isn't going to come out for another 4 months. 4 months. And the reason the publisher gave was the supply chain.
Wow. And obviously colliding with the holiday season, books are a very popular gift to give to friends and loved ones. So when you hunted around and to find the connection between the supply chain and holiday book giving, what did you find out?
It makes a lot more sense than I ever would have thought. Pretty much every step of the printing process is behind schedule for the same reasons we're hearing about in other parts of the supply chain. Paper, in general, is in short supply. Well, we've heard that there isn't enough toilet paper from time to time. We've heard lumber is in short supply. It's all made from the same resource. Also, a lot of printing is done overseas. China is very big on doing full-color books, printing of books. There's also a lot of printing that happens in Hong Kong and Germany. And since there are staff shortages all over the country and all over the world because of COVID, printing schedules are getting behind a little bit everywhere. And you would think, well, why not just use a printer in North America? We have the same problems, shortages of staff, shortages of paper. So it's the same set of problems here. Now, I spoke with Kathy Thomas. She heads marketing for the national book chain called Half Price Books. And she said it's just really hard to find good printing alternatives.
I think in the last year and a half since COVID, everyone has been looking at Canada, Mexico. They went to India, some went to Singapore to try to get the product out. But now it's everywhere it's an issue. The factories, not only can they not get the products, but their employees are sick and they have to, you know, they have COVID. So they're shutting down, and where they used to produce 1,000 manufacturing 1,000 books an hour, it's only 100 because they just don't have the workforce to assemble. And I think that it's just everywhere.
That's just incredible. I mean, from 1,000 books an hour to only 100. And I think further compounding this is that we are in the second holiday season in a pandemic. So when it comes to that, this is the second holiday season during a pandemic. We're 20 months into this. How is this different from what this industry faced last year?
It's very similar, but you just nailed it. Nobody thought that this was going to happen for 20 months and counting. That's the part that no one was really ready for. Now, the booksellers saw the slowdown, obviously. They knew in June and July that they were going to have to really do something special and early for this holiday season. And they tried to do the right thing with their holiday inventory, but it didn't help because everybody's in the same boat. So the online booksellers, the indies, the chains, whether you go in person or shop online, all the booksellers are in exactly the same boat. They're all facing work force issues, and they're all facing shipping problems. You know, all the container ships that we are hearing about in the Port of LA and the Port of Oakland, some of those container ships have books on them. So we're all facing the same thing. And each part of this supply chain is a problem in terms of time. It's also a problem in terms of money. When we do our holiday shopping, we expect to see deals. We expect to see discounts. And that might not be the case this year. In fact, some prices might be higher than expected because of the supply chain slowdowns. Here is an example of how the costs and the different steps of the supply chain affect the books we buy. This is Stacy Gould of Ruby's Books in Folsom.
I think it's mostly the cost of paper is going up, the cost of shipping is going up. I recently read that the cost of shipping was up, you know, over 30% on books. And so, yeah, I think the costs are up everywhere. And it mostly plays in for books that were pre-ordered for long periods of time. Like, for example, the Amanda Gorman book that everyone was so excited about right after the inauguration. Every bookstore in America took pre-orders for that book and got lots of pre-orders. And now we've all been waiting and waiting for it to come out. And then the publisher announced that it's going to cost $5 more. And so the booksellers are forced to say, like, okay, well, our customers that already paid for it, do we have to turn around and then say, I'm sorry, this costs more now, or do we have to eat the difference? For my customers that pre-ordered, I'm going to eat the difference and just say, okay, these customers were loyal to me when this was a hot thing months ago and they could have gotten it from anywhere. And I'll honor that loyalty by charging what I told them I would.
I talked to another book owner, co-owner of Capital Books, Ross Rojak in Sacramento. He's a person who feels he's pretty savvy about ordering books, about tracking books. And he says that's all well and good to be on top of that, but after you order them, it's pretty much out of control.
That starts depending on publishers or sources. So Penguin Random House, they have a two-day ship policy, and they have a warehouse up in Reno. So if it's in the Reno warehouse, I should get it in 2 days. If it's shipping from the East Coast, technically I should have it in 3, 1 day to process the order, 2 days to ship. But that's counting on the shipping facilities to be able to get it there. That's counting on Penguin Random House having it. And all of the publishers start falling behind around Thanksgiving. And so, again, if you're, you know, doing this proactively, you stay in touch with your sales rep. How far behind is the warehouse? Are you on a 1 week delay, 2 week delay, 3 week delay? And everybody gives you a date. They're like, okay, if you don't have an order in by December 16th, it's not going to get there before Christmas. And so we have a calendar that basically has all of those dates on there that says Drop Dead Simon & Schuster, Drop Dead Penguin Random House. On the other end of it, you have to involve weather too. So our primary supplier is up in Oregon, in the middle of Oregon, and they are very, very good to us. We got lucky in our location because they use a California-based shipping company, well, West Coast-based, but mostly California. And so when they ship everybody's stuff to California, it comes into Sacramento where their hub is, and they break it out. So they are typically a next-day delivery for us, and we take advantage of that. We order pretty much every morning, noon, we turn in an order, we get product for them the next day. Unless, of course, there's snow in the Siskiyou and it's winter.
And of course, there's always snow on 50 in winter.
Of course, over Donner Summit, in Echo Summit, you're painting such a sad and lonely picture at bookstores. Are bookstores empty?
No, they're not empty at all. There are plenty of books, and a lot of the books in the bookstores are recent releases, but there's limited supplies. A couple of booksellers said they could order 50 copies of a new book, but only get 40 of them. Everything's backed up and everything's just a little bit less in terms of the numbers that are coming in. So even though the bookstores are full, you might not be able to get every book on your wish list. And special orders are going to be tough this year.
Wow. I mean, anything else we should know about the books and holidays? People are thinking about buying books despite obviously learning of these supply chain issues. What advice do you have for people?
Some pretty good advice, and it's pretty simple if you think about it. Shop early, be flexible. Everybody in the supply chain is doing their best. No one's goofing off. It's just circumstances this year. A couple of the booksellers said, why not buy a gift card this year? Why not throw in a real nice bookmark to make it a perfect book? And they all reminded me that their job, they love books, their job is to put the perfect books in our hands as shoppers. So listen to their advice, maybe walk out with a little bit of a surprise for yourself and the person on your list.
You know, let's go back to John, because we started with him, and I imagine he is not the only author whose release date was postponed.
No, not at all. It's happening to a lot of authors. A lot of publication dates have been pushed back. That's a cue to us, too, as customers, that we have to be flexible and we have to be patient. I talked with Mary Bisbee Beek. She's a publicist. She also connects authors with publishers, and she gave me an example.
A wonderful children's book that was supposed to come out in August is now, the pub date is now November, late November. Printed in China, difficulty in getting to the US, but made it to the warehouse in Chicago. But now the difficulty is getting the books from Chicago to the various bookstores in time for the holiday, because it's the ground transportation. They're talking about putting it on a train. Air freight is out of the question. It's too out of the ballpark expensive. But that's the whole picture right there. You know, we have lots of stop signs along the way, and we're all having to stop.
And I also imagine, Donna, that when it comes to being patient and being flexible, that also comes on your end when you want to interview these authors.
Yeah, it slows things down a little bit for me and for them. But John Lesquois' book is coming out in March, and we've agreed that we will have an interview with him then.
Thank you so much, Donna.
Thanks, Vicki.
And that is my conversation with CAP Radio Morning Edition host Donna Appadoni about how the supply chain issue are affecting the book industry. We chatted last week. That's it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez, Nick Dobis, and Pauline Bartolone, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer, Chris Feltz. Joe Barr is CAP Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you right back here tomorrow.